الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبو قاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم brothers and sisters, it's my honor to be here to speak in front of you. I ask you for one thing tonight because I'm extremely tired right now, so I need you to send loud salawats to wake me up, make sure I don't fall asleep in front of you. Now inshallah, let's start the speech by sending three loud salawats for the reappearance of Imam Zaman, alayhi salam. In the last few nights, I've been talking about different reasons behind Ashura. And I said every single night, I'm going to mention one reason. The first night was reforming the Ummah. We moved from there to Amr bil Ma'ruf, to reviving the Prophet's Sunnah, to other things as well. Today's topic is fighting ignorance, is saving mankind from misguidance. Okay? Now, one thing in Shia Islam, what we have is we have very special du'as. We also have very special ziyarahs. Now, the conditions of the imams throughout history changed. Sometimes the imams were free and they were able to teach Islam in a very easy way, open way in the masjid. They said Imam Sadiq alayhi salam had over 4,000 students in the masjid. Sometimes the prophets were not free, and they were not able to teach Islam the way it should be taught. They resorted to teaching us the principles of Islam through prayer. In their du'as, they would show us very special concepts and very special things that we should hold dear to ourselves in regards to Islam. Now I'm going to mention one ziyarat here, and in this ziyarat, we see that a couple reasons for Imam Hussein's uprising are mentioned in the ziyarat. The ziyarat is called Ziyarat al-Arba'in, and we recite this ziyarat 40 days after the 10th of Muharram, 40 days after Imam Hussein alayhi salam became a Shaheed. The ziyarat starts by praising Imam Hussein, by giving him positive attributes. For instance, it says, As-salamu ala wali Allah wa habibih. May peace be upon you, the wali of Allah, the guardian of Allah, and his beloved. As-salamu ala khalil Allah wa najibih. May Allah, peace be upon you, O friend of Allah, and his najib. As-salamu ala safi Allah wa nasafiyyeh. May peace be upon you, the chosen, and the son of the chosen. So we see the ziyarat starts by praising Imam Hussein. Then it moves on later on to state some of the reasons behind Ashura. It says, لِيَسْتَنْقَذْ عِبَادَكْ مِنْ جَهَالِ وَحِرَةِ دُلَالَةِ. In order to save your servants from ignorance and misguidance. In order to save your servants from ignorance and misguidance. So here in the ziyarat, it's telling us one of the reasons behind the uprising of Ashura. One of the reasons that Imam Hussein rose up and gave his life was to fight ignorance, was to save mankind from misguidance. Salawat ala Muhammad wa remember I said loud salawat. Now, when we talk about ignorance, there's many different aspects of ignorance. Ignorance can be explained in many different ways. What I'm going to do is I'm going to explain two main categories of ignorance. While I'm explaining them, I'm going to be explaining them in accordance to Islamic jurisprudence, in accordance to fiqh. But then I'm going to mention an akhlaqi point, and then I'm going to get into a theological discussion. So when we're discussing this concept of ignorance, inshallah we'll get a complete, you know, view of it, a complete opinion of it. Because we know it's the three main branches of Islam are fiqh, akhlaq, and theology, akhlaq. So I'll touch upon all of these. First of all, we break up ignorance into ignorance about the subject and ignorance about the rule. I'll explain what that means. And then when we break up ignorance about the rule, we have one case where the person could have learned about the rule, and we have another case where the person was unable, did not have the ability to learn about the rule. So we have two categories, and then two subcategories. What I mean by ignorance of the subject. One of the children asked this question in a question and answer session a few days ago, but I'm going to reiterate it tonight with a little more detail. What this means is that you know what the ruling is. You know what the Islamic law is, but you're doubting about the instance. What does that mean? For instance, you know that alcohol is haram. It is haram to consume alcohol. Everyone knows that. But this cup right here, you don't know that this is alcohol. It's water. You think it's water, and then you drink it, and you see it was alcohol. It was vodka. In this case, Allah is not going to punish you. Why? Because you knew what the ruling was. You knew the ruling was that drinking alcohol is haram. You did not know what the subject was. This is the subject. The cup of water is called the subject, the instance. You didn't know that this was alcohol. That's the first case. That's simple, that's clear, it's not very difficult. The second case is when you don't know what the rule is. You know this is alcohol. I was with a cup of vodka, right? You know that this is alcohol. But you don't know that drinking alcohol is haram. So you're ignorant about the rule. Here we have two different categories. In one side, we could say, if the person is able to learn the rule, but doesn't, why wouldn't he learn the rule? He's lazy. He doesn't want to go on the internet and go on the website of his marriage and read his ruling. He doesn't want to open the book of Islamic laws that he has in his house. He doesn't want to ask the ulama that are in Los Angeles. He doesn't want to find out. He's lazy. In this case, Allah is going to punish him. On the day of judgment, Allah is going to say, why did you drink this vodka? He's going to say, I didn't know it was haram. Allah will say, why didn't you learn? And then he won't have an answer for that. Allah will punish you. So this is one case. The second case is when you're unable to find out. For instance, the example they gave is someone who lives in the Amazon jungle and has no access to the internet, has no access to books of Islamic laws, has no access to ulama, has no access to anything. There's no way for him to find out that Islam says drinking vodka is haram. In this case, the person will not be punished. This is what we say in fiqh. Now, the akhlaqi point that I wanted to mention. If the first case, that I know alcohol is haram, but I didn't know that this was alcohol and I drank this, will it have a negative effect on my soul or not? A lot of times people raise this question when they're talking about meat. Because we know that we have to eat halal meat, we cannot eat haram meat. And sometimes, for instance, one of the ways to determine if meat is halal is if a Muslim tells us, if we go to a Muslim's house and he gives us the meat, we can eat it. We don't even have to ask if it's halal or haram. We can eat the meat. Now, if in actuality this meat was haram, would that have a negative effect on our souls? We didn't commit a haram action. It was halal for us to eat it. But will it affect our souls negatively? That's a question. There's two answers to this. There's one group of scholars that say yes, it will have a negative effect on your soul. So you should be extremely careful what you eat. You should go through rigorous examinations You should make your life difficult, basically, to make sure never one molecule of something haram is going into your body. This is one point of view. But that is the unpopular view. The popular view, the view that the majority of the teachers of akhlaq have, the teachers of Islamic ethics, is that if you eat something that was halal for you, you did not know it was vodka and you took a sip and a little bit of it went down your throat before you realized. It wasn't haram for you. If you ate meat at a brother's house, at a Muslim's house, and this Muslim gave you haram meat and you didn't know, it wasn't haram for you to eat it. In this case, it will not have a negative effect on your soul. But someone might ask a question, what about the hadith? You see hadith that says if you drink alcohol for 40 days, your prayers will not be accepted. It doesn't say if you drunk it in a halal way or a haram way. It just says if you drunk alcohol, your prayers are not accepted for 40 days. The teachers answer this question. They say that, listen, Allah is the one who created the system of cause and effect. Allah created the cause, drinking alcohol, to have the effect of the prayers being rejected for 40 days. If Allah is the one who created that, Allah can also nullify it. There's no problem for Allah to come and say, in this case, that it was halal for you to drink it, I'm gonna take away the negative effects that it would have had. And this is how they answer that. Salawat ala Muhammad. Now the theological point. The theological point is actually a pretty interesting discussion. Now, we're gonna take the same doubt, ignorance, right? And we're going to apply it to a theological issue. For instance, the existence of God. We know that we have to believe that God exists. And we have to have a proof for this. It's not that I can't tell you God exists and you accept that. You have to have a proof between you and Allah of why you believe that God exists. But let's say somebody does not know. There's two cases here. One is that he could have known, he could have researched, he could have thought about it, he could have looked into it, but he didn't. He was lazy. He didn't want to think about religion. He wanted to go to the clubs, he wanted to play sports, he wanted to have fun. He didn't want to think about religion at all. In this case, everybody says that this person will be held responsible. On the day of judgment, this person will be held responsible for not having the correct beliefs. But what if he was unable? He did not have any books. He was, again, in the Amazon or somewhere remote that he has no access to any books or any religious, theory. In this case, what is his responsibility? Will he be punished the same? The answer is no. This person will not be punished. How will he be judged? Allah will judge him in accordance to what he knows. So whatever he knows to be right, whatever he knows to be good, he should perform it. Whatever he knows to be bad, if he performed it, Allah will punish him. To the extent of his knowledge, to the extent of the knowledge that he has about good and bad, he'll be judged. Shaheed Mutahiri, in a book called Divine Justice, it's translated into English, it's probably online, you can probably find it. This is a very interesting book. In this book, he discusses an issue, he takes it a step farther. He says, what about in the West? Or what about in, some Wahhabi village in Saudi Arabia? Where, in the village in Saudi Arabia, where they say Shias are kafirs. They say that Shias are, there's no way that Shia Islam is correct. And the person is born in that village and dies in that village. And he would never have thought that if there's the smallest possibility that Shiism is correct. Not even the smallest possibility, because of the negative propaganda that he was given. In this case, it's possible that that person would be similar to the person in the Amazon jungle, that he would be judged in accordance to what he knows. Because there was no possibility of him having one, of him giving a chance to Shia Islam. Shahid Mutahiri says, in the West, about Islam might be the same. Which, me personally, I don't know if I agree with this or not. I'm just letting you know what he says. He says that in the West, they speak so negatively about Islam. Islam is portrayed in such a bad way that nobody in their right mind would say, oh, I want to become a Muslim. Nobody in their right mind would say that Islam is possible to be a correct religion. No one would say that. And if that's the case, if it is, I'm not saying it is, that's his interpretation. If that's the case in the West, then people in the West would be similar to the person in the Amazon. So that's a theological debate that exists. And in the book Divine Justice, you could read it, and it'll give you further details if you want to get into it more deeply. Salawat ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Now, we mentioned that the ziyarat, and we said that one of the reasons why Imam Hussein stood up, one of the reasons behind his movement, was to fight ignorance and to save mankind from misguidance. That means in this society there was a lot of ignorance. That means in the society that he lived in, the society was full of ignorance for him to have to stand up to fight against. Now, one of the main instances of ignorance that the people of that society had was that they did not recognize who their enemies were. There's a concept that we have called Doshman Shinasi, for those who speak Farsi, or knowing your enemy. And it's very important for one to be able to recognize who their enemy is. During that time of Islam, especially during the reign of Muawiyah and Yazid, the Muslims were unable to recognize who their real enemies were. Sometimes they thought the Ahlul Bayt were the enemies. The enemies of Islam, they stood up to fight against them. How many times did they fight against Imam Ali alayhi salam when he was the Khalifa? When after he became Shaheed, Imam Hassan alayhi salam was the Imam. They stood up to him. He didn't even have enough followers to fight against Muawiyah. He was forced to sign a peace treaty. In the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the people rose up against Imam Hussein. A huge army went to kill the grandson of the Prophet. They completely, misunderstood who the real enemy is. They thought the Ahlul Bayt were the enemies, not Muawiyah and Yazid. Now, in this day and age, let's relate that to today. For Shias that are living in this world, we have to be able to recognize who our enemies are. We have to know who Imam Hussein of today is. We have to know who Yazid of today is. We have that famous saying that says, every land is Karbala and every day is Ashura. That means, right now, is Ashura, right here, in Canoga Park, is Karbala. That's what that means, everywhere, every day. That means we have to know the Yazids and the Husseins of today. Now, when I go throughout the Islamic, communities in the West and throughout the world, I usually talk to people, and it seems like there's some groups where the most important fight that they have is between Sunnis and Shias. Nothing is more important than this fight. A Shia has to prove that Imam Ali was the rightful successor of the Prophet. And the Sunni has to prove that Abu Bakr and Omar were good people. You see this fight all the time. You see they're fighting about how many times to wash their hands in wuzu, when the enemy is trying to cut our hands off. It's ridiculous. There's no way that our main enemy in the world today are Sunnis, or for the Sunnis that are Shias. There is some fighting that's going on. But we have to work towards unity on that issue. I'm not saying compromise our religion. I'm saying stop fighting amongst each other. Because we have enemies who are killing us. While we're arguing about small, insignificant historical points, non-believers are killing Muslims. While we're arguing about differences in our belief system, non-believers are raping Muslim women. While we're arguing about differences in our opinions about Islamic law, non-Muslims are shooting our children when they're walking to school. Look at Palestine. Everyone sees it every day. I mean, it's not in the Western media too much, but if you could look on YouTube, if you have satellite, I'm sure you see pictures of it. Look at the atrocities that are happening there, and we're busy fighting amongst ourselves. Even forget Sunni Shia. Shias are fighting amongst themselves, a follower of this marriage, a follower of that marriage. This person said this word, this person said that word. We have to be able to recognize who the real enemy is today. This is very important. Salawat ala Muhammad. Now let's go back to the history, and then I'll go back to the future, to the present day as well. After Muawiyah passed away, when he died, a person named Marwan ibn Hakam came and he called for Imam Hussein to come meet him. He wanted Imam Hussein to pledge allegiance to Yazid. This is why Imam Hussein stood up. He refused to pledge this allegiance. If he pledged allegiance to Yazid, there would be no fighting. There would be no bloodshed. Imam Hussein would not have been martyred. His family would not have been martyred. So Imam Hussein rejected. He did not go. It's narrated that the next day, these two people met on the street. Marwan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam met on the street. And Marwan told him, he said, look, pledge allegiance to Imam Hussein. It'll be good for you in this world and the next. Why don't you do it? What was Imam Hussein's response? He said, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Verily we are from Allah, and to him we will return. Then he said, if the Muslims are led by the likes of Yazid ibn Muawiyah, then we should bid farewell to Islam. Islam will be destroyed. We cannot have people like that as our leader. He continued, after this, he narrated a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The Prophet said this, I'm going to translate it from the Arabic. The Prophet said that the Khilafat is deprived upon the family of Abi Sufyan. That the family of Abi Sufyan, this is the Prophet saying this. He said the family of Abu Sufyan cannot be the Khalifas. These people cannot be the Khalifas. The Prophet goes on. He says, if you see Muawiyah upon my pulpit, on my minbar, kill him. Kill him. Then he goes, then, what's it called? Imam Hussein continues. He said, the people of Medina saw Muawiyah on the pulpit and did not kill him. So then what happened? Ya Mawlana, what happened? Therefore, فَإِبْتَلَاهُ Allah bi Yazid al-Fasiq, and Allah inflicted them with Yazid the corrupt, the Fasiq. If we have a corrupt leader, Imam Ali alayhi salam in Najm al-Balagha, I don't have the exact quote, but the gist of what he says is that the people follow their leaders. The people follow their leaders. If you have a corrupt leader, the society will follow him. If Yazid is able to be the leader of the Islamic world, Islam will be destroyed. There will be no more Islam. Now, what did Yazid do? Every night I've been mentioning a few things about Yazid just to, so we could be reminded of how bad of a person he was. He was famous for being bad. Amongst the Muslim Ummah, everyone knew he was bad. He was famous for being a murderer, for being an alcoholic, for being a womanizer. There's a story, I don't know how many of you have read, but there was one time he gathered an army and he attacked Medina. I don't know if you read about that in history. He attacked Medina. He killed men and women and whoever was there. And then after he killed, all the opposition, he did something much worse. He allowed his soldiers 3 days of respite. What's that mean? He allowed them for 3 days to do whatever they want to the people of Medina. To the women, to the men, to the children, whatever they wanted, they were free. 3 days, Medina was in complete mayhem because of Yazid. This is Yazid. Another instance. We have a rule in Islam that if someone takes refuge in the Kaaba, we have to leave them alone. We can't attack them. Abdullah ibn Zubair, Yazid was trying to get him. Abdullah ibn Zubair went to the Kaaba, took refuge. Do you think Yazid listened to this rule? He didn't listen to any other rule. So of course he didn't listen to this. He surrounded the Kaaba. He didn't let any food or water into the Haram. He starved Abdullah ibn Zubair to death. And when he came out, he had people throw rocks at him. Captured him and punished him. This is Yazid. This is the person who they're telling Imam Hussein al-Islam to pledge allegiance to bow down to. There's no way the like of Imam Hussein al-Islam can pledge allegiance to the like of Yazid. It's impossible. And if it happens, Islam would be destroyed. That's why Imam Hussein had to stand up. Salawat alayhi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now when you're fighting ignorance, right? When you want to fight ignorance, there's two ways to approach it. Okay? Let's say there's a brother sitting next to me and he's ignorant. I can speak to him rationally. I can give him rational proofs. I could show him historical sources. We could have an intellectual discussion. And there'd be no problem with that. And it's possible that he would accept it. But that doesn't work every time. Because sometimes some people are so far asleep. They're in a deep sleep. They're so far from reality that a rational discussion will have no effect on them. That it will go in one ear and out the other. You won't even think about it. So what do you have to do with these people? How do you fight ignorance with these people? You have to shock them. You have to take them out of their comfort zone. You have to do something that makes them open their eyes. This is what Imam Hussein did. When Imam Hussein gave his life, he gave first all of the companions became shaheed. His family members, one by one. His little child, 6-month-old child. Himself, when they decapitated the heads, put them on the spears, walked them through the desert, through the different cities to show the people. When they did this, it shocked the people. People woke up. People said, what is this? This is the grandson of the Prophet. These are the women of the household of the Prophet. Why are you putting them in prison? They were shocked. Imam Hussein stood up. Imam Hussein sacrificed himself. So people would be saved from this ignorance. People would wake up. People would not be misguided anymore. Is that what happened? Right after Ashura, Mukhtar stood up, took revenge. The Tawabin movement started, took revenge. People realized that we made a mistake. We realize now. And then they fought. They killed most of the people who took part in Yazid's army. Also, we see that Imam Hussein's grandson, Imam Bakr alayhi salam, during his time, the Bani Umayyah was destroyed. It only took two generations after Imam Hussein that the Bani Umayyah collapsed. This seed was sown in Karbala. The seed of the collapse of these tyrants happened in Karbala through the Shahadat of Imam Hussein. And this is one of the reasons why he stood up. Now every night, I tell you that these speeches are not meant to be theoretical, they're meant to be practical. And I really want you to take that from these speeches. I don't want you to take anything theoretical. I want you to come to these speeches and to take away something practical. I want there to be something that you could do when you go home. I want there to be something that you could do until the next Muharram, when inshallah I see you again or someone else comes in front of you. We have to make a change in our lives. Now when Imam Hussein stood up to fight ignorance, so we must do the same. We have to teach people about Islam. We have to teach Muslims about Islam. We have to teach our children. We have to teach our community. But most important, we have to teach ourselves. We can't say that we're know-it-alls. All of us need to learn Islam in a deeper form. Every single one of us, myself included, we have to continue our daily struggle to learn more and more about our religion. There's so much out there. The more you don't know. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know. Now, how can we do this? How can we learn more about our religion? It's not difficult. There's books, there's the internet, there's classes. There's a class that I know of that's held in UCLA, which is close by, every Tuesday night. You can go there, you can attend the class, and I promise you, you'll learn. I promise you the knowledge that you get at that class will help you to get closer to Allah. Anyone who wants to learn more about their religion can easily do it in Los Angeles, wherever they are in Los Angeles. But I wanted to mention one step that's a little farther than that. First of all, I want to say that the most comprehensive school, the most comprehensive theories and concepts that you could learn will be in the Hausa. You can't learn Islam in anywhere as you would in the Hausa. That's a fact. The Hausa, their whole purpose is to teach Islam. Now, some people say that it is wajib to go to the Hausa. Actually, everybody, every madrasa says it is wajib, obligatory, to go to the Hausa. I told him Makarim Shirazi, I heard him myself, and he's my teacher, I attend his classes. And he said before one of his classes, he said, it is wajib aini for anybody who has the ability to study Islam to enter the Hausa today. Very clear. Since most of you don't do taqlid to Ayatollah Makarim Shirazi, Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, other Ayatollahs, other Maraja, all of them say, wajib al-kafai'i, it's wajib. Meaning, and if enough people go to the Hausa and become strong scholars and are able to teach their communities, then it's not wajib for anyone else. But if there's not enough people there, then it's wajib for everyone to go who has the ability. Now it's up to us to determine if there's enough people or not. But I'm going to give you one story. And when you listen to this story, after you hear this story, make your mind up. In Iran, you know that the population of Iran is about 70 million people, give or take. They have about 40,000 religious students in Iran, 40,000 Iranian scholars. It could be, again, more or less. That's just a ballpark figure. Now, one time, Ayatollah Mohsen Iraqi, who was the representative of Sayyid Khamenei in London, I heard him say this story myself. He said that one of the most famous speakers in Iran came and he delivered a lecture. And in this lecture, a number of the Muraja were present in the front row, filled of Muraja, and he's delivering a lecture. He says, I'm gonna say something. And if I'm wrong, it's the duty of you Muraja who are sitting right here to stand up and tell me I'm wrong. He said, right now, we need at least 100,000 religious scholars in Iran, which would be 1/70th of the population. And because we don't have that number, it is wajib, obligatory for anybody who can to come to the Hauza and study Islam. None of the Muraja stood up. None of the Muraja said this was wrong. But after the speech ended, one of the marajas came up to the speaker. And he said, you know what? What you said was wrong. I don't agree with that. So the speaker said, okay, tell me, what's your opinion? He said, it's not 100,000. Until we get 1,000,000 students, it is wajib for everyone to go. Now in America, we have a population of how many million? 300 million people. Okay? Now, I know they're non-Muslim, Iran is Muslim. So let's not say we don't need 1,000,000. Let's say 1,000. 1,000. How many students do we have from the West in Qom right now? Less than 20. How many scholars do we have that grew up in the West, that relate to Western issues, that can relate to people in the West, the youth? How many scholars do we have like that in Los Angeles, throughout the United States? 10 at the most? So do you think there's a need? If you think there's a need, then there's a responsibility. If you don't think there's a need, that's fine. But if you think there's a need, you have a responsibility. Salawat ala Muhammad. Now I want to speak a little bit about one of the people who stood up and fought against ignorance. One of the people who stood up and fought against misguidance. One of the people that we should take lessons from. One of the people that we should try to emulate, that we should try to be like. And this person is, his name is Qasim. He's the son of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Now after his brother, Abu Bakr ibn Imam Hassan, after he became shaheed, Qasim left the tent. Qasim was a small child. He was not baligh, he was not an adult. There's differences in the age that he was, but he was very small. When he left the tent, Imam Hussein saw him. Imam Hussein saw him, Imam Hussein started to cry. Now brothers and sisters, these are the final days of Muharram. We don't have many days left. I know the setting isn't perfect, but we have to try to cry for Imam Hussein. We have to try to make it emotional. Now, when Imam Hussein alayhi salam saw Qasim, he started to cry. Of course he knew what was going to happen. Maybe he pictured in his mind what's going to happen in a few minutes. But he couldn't contain himself and he was crying. Qasim did not go up to him at that point. Qasim waited until Imam Hussein was alone. When Imam Hussein was alone, Qasim went to him. Qasim asked for permission to go to the bathroom. Imam Hussein looked at him, he's too small. Small little kid. He said, no. I'm not going to give you permission. Qasim begged him and begged him, insisted. insisted and insisted. A little kid. You know. They said he kissed his uncle's hand. He kissed his uncle's feet. Let me go in front. Until Imam Hussein finally gave him the permission. Finally he gave him the permission. And Qasim went out to the battlefield. There's a person named Hamid ibn Muslim. This is one of the people who narrated the story of Kaaba. He said, Kharaja Elena Bulon, a small boy came out towards us. He had a sword in his hand. And he was wearing a shirt. He was too small. He wasn't even wearing armor. Armor would not fit on his body. He was so small. He went out to the battlefield, and it seemed like he completely disregarded the enemy. He would fight against the enemy, and then he would go down and would fix his shoe. He didn't give him any significance. He would recite poetry when he was fighting. He would say, "Don't you know me? I'm the son of Hassan. I'm the grandson of the Prophet of Nabi Mustafa. I'm the trust of Allah. That's Hussein. You've imprisoned him. You've surrounded him. You are the people who mercy will not shower upon." He recited poetry in Arabic like this as he was fighting. Now, a person by the name of Amr ibn Sa'd. Amr ibn Sa'd, he came and he looked at Qasim. He said, "I'm gonna kill this kid." The person next to him said, "What's the problem? He's just a kid." He said, "No, I'm gonna put this on my shoulder, I'm gonna kill him." And he stood up and he ran towards Qasim. A man, a big man, little kid. Qasim stood there bravely, but what can you do? This man, Amr ibn Sa'd, came and struck Qasim on the head one time. Qasim fell down. As he's falling down face first into the ground, he screams, "Ya Amr, oh my uncle, oh my uncle." Imam Hussein is heartbroken. Imam Hussein can't take it. Imam Hussein rushes to his side. As he's rushing to his side, he strikes. He tries to attack the one who killed him. And it said that Amr ibn Sa'd, he put his hand up to defend, and Imam Hussein struck his hand and made such a loud noise that everyone heard that his hand broke. When that happened, this person's tribe came to his rescue. And they all came and a huge commotion happened. Dust filled the skies. The bodies of Qasim was trampled upon. And when the dust settled, you saw Imam Hussein next to Qasim. He started cursing the people who killed him. He said, "May the mercy of Allah be distant from those who killed you." He said, "May the people who killed you be resurrected on the day of judgment, enemies to the Prophet." And then he said something that was very heartfelt. He expressed his feelings. He said it was very difficult. This Qasim, he's dead. But Imam Hussein is speaking to him. He said it was very difficult that you called for your uncle and I was unable to answer. I tried my best, but I couldn't come in time. He said it was very difficult that when I came it was too late. That I couldn't be a benefit to you. And then he grabbed Qasim. He held him to his chest and he walked him to the tent. Brought him back to the women. And it said that the feet of Qasim was dragging through the sand of Kaaba. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Inshallah, may us all have to become strong like this small child, Qasim ibn Hassan. May us all be able to use these nights of Muharram to get closer to Allah. May Allah help us to learn more about our religion so we can teach others and ourselves. And may Allah hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman And may Allah bless our leader, Sayyid Ali Khan.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.